At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on Newstalk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, what did the first stars in our universe look like and why can we find no trace of them now? Dr. Emmett Chapman will be talking about the dark ages of our universe. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at Newstalk Science, or you can text us for 30 cent 53106. And we get to your comments in the podcast. Find it in the Newstalk app or wherever you find your podcasts. Just search for Future Proof. Now, predictable as we are, it's time to look back at the week's science news, as we've done for the last 11 years at the top of the show. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that hang me.
Shane, is a story about a new Irish science paper that is very exciting, looking at inherited vision loss.
Yeah, absolutely. And it uses gene therapy, which is an exciting new way of doing medicine. And this is work from researchers in Trinity College Dublin and the Royal Victoria Eye and Ear Hospital, which is just around the corner from Urthra Terrace in town. They published a paper on something called dominant optic atrophy. And it is a genetically caused condition that until now has had no real cure to prevent it or to kind of undo it. And this is a really exciting work, not just because it has potential for this particular optical disease, but it offers a new treatment path for many others that are caused by the same mechanism. So DOA, as it's called, this is the disease, it's caused by a degeneration of the optic nerve. And it normally happens in the first decade of life. And as I said, there's no way to prevent or cure it. A gene provides instruction to make a particular protein that's pivotal to the function of cells that are associated with it. Now, the protein is associated with the energy part of the cell to keep it going. And without that protein, some people just don't or have a genetic abnormality, so they can't produce the protein.
Yeah.
So it's suboptimal, and eventually there is vision loss, and that can't be undone. So what's happened here, and the researchers have taken genes and they've edited them in mice, and they've shown that they've been able to undo the atrophy, which is absolutely fantastic. It's remarkable. They use a virus to insert it into the cells of the mice, and they're able to repair things. So this gene therapy, as it's called, can provide benefits not just for this optical issue, but it could work for a wider array of diseases that are associated with the same cellular dysfunction, so associated with the same issue on that gene. So
yeah.
Fantastic to see this happen. It really is groundbreaking.
And we spoke only a couple of weeks ago with Professor John Flannery from UC Berkeley, who's using gene therapy to work on inherited vision loss in a different way, by sort of hijacking cells that don't normally take in light and getting them to do the function of the rods and cones. So it's a really exciting time for research, particularly in the area of gene therapies and blindness. So very exciting work and great to hear some Irish science involved. Susan, our second story has to do with vegetarians.
Yeah, so one of the biggest and best undertakings in scientific research is longitudinal studies. So this is where health-related outcomes are associated maybe with different factors over time. And they often result in advice or knowledge that we know as a fact. For example, there is the Framingham Heart Study, which was started in the 1950s, and it has led to the discovery that cigarette smoking increases the risk of heart disease, or that exercise in fact decreases it. So these studies show us things that then become part of our knowledge of science and health. So since 1993, the EPIC Oxford study has showed, has studied 65,000 men and women to see how diet influences cancer and other chronic diseases. And this week they published results showing that non-meat eaters are significantly more likely to suffer from broken bones than meat eaters. They divided the cohort of people into meat eaters, pescatarians, vegetarians and vegans, and then documented their admission to hospital for broken bones over the course of about 20 years.
What about flexitarians?
And pescatarians are people who eat fish.
No, I know that.
Sorry.
Flexitarians, Susan.
You know what? There's a lot more. I don't know that.
flexitarians are people who sort of don't eat a lot of meat, but they want acknowledgement for it, essentially. I think that's what it is.
I know,
flexitarians,
you're right.
Are people who do eat a bit of meat, but not a huge amount, but they want a bit of credit for it.
There's an endless list of titles, are there not?
Seminarian? Probably not relevant. Sorry, go on. So they looked at these various diets and the likelihood of them breaking their bones.
Yes, was higher with people that didn't eat meat. They did adjust for socioeconomic factors, for lifestyle choices, for their BMI, and they still found that the vegans broke their hips more than twice the rate of those of the other categories, and that the vegetarians and pescatarians had an increased risk of about 25%. Now, we do know that vegans and vegetarians can have weaker bones, but once they supplement with calcium and make sure they're getting the right amount of protein on their daily basis, that you can still maintain a healthy diet on these diets. But I suppose what they're saying is maybe in the 90s when this started, it wasn't maybe as prevalent, you know, fortifying plant-based foods and milk. So it does show that if you do, you know, if you don't substitute with and keep up, you know, sort of your supplements of the calcium and protein, that you will get weaker bones, and then ultimately you'll be at higher risk for these types of fractures.
So if you're still on vegan 1.0, for example, it's not the healthiest diet. You want to upgrade to vegan 2.0, which is still just eating plant based food, but supplementing it with, I don't know, what do they supplement with, Susan?
I mean, I think as long as you eat plenty of tofu, I think there's plenty of calcium and lots of other leafy greens as well. My daughter is dairy free for other reasons, for allergic reasons. We just have to make sure we give her calcium from other forms as well. So, I mean, there's plenty out there. You just have to have a varied diet. And obviously in the 90s, I don't know if it was something that they were as aware of, whereas these kinds of studies over this length of time really shows and demonstrates the evidence for this type of...
Does your daughter have a name?
I have two daughters. Yes, they both have names. I did name
no,
them.
No, I mean, does she have a name? Like, is she, you know, are dairy-free people, do they get a name? Not does your daughter has it. It would be very weird if you hadn't named
your daughter. My second daughter was born with allergies to wheat, milk, eggs, and nuts. And my other daughter has an allergy to all the pulses. So we just call them awkward children.
Awkwardarians. Yeah, very good. Okay, thanks very much for that, Susan. Our third story, Shane, has to do with China.
It does. A new Chinese spacecraft Tuesday last set off for the moon. It is quite the time for lunar activity. We've spoken about many missions of late, and this is the latest Chinese effort. This is a Chang'e 5 probe that's going to land on the moon, incredibly, and bring back rock samples in mid-December.
What does Chang'e mean? Shane?
I have no idea, but what I find very interesting is that it is on top of a Long March 5 rocket. Talk about an ominously named. I have problems with the restaurant chain called Mao for various reasons, but the Long March 5 really takes the biscuit.
Yeah, it's so a sort it's of a Aldous Huxley naming convention the Chinese have. Go on.
Yeah, indeed. So it'll be back in mid-December, and it is more than 40 years since anyone has taken back rock sample from the moon. The US and the Soviets were the only ones that did it. What's different about this mission is that it is entirely robotic. But apart from that, it has the components that we'd be familiar with from the likes of Apollo 13 styled films, and that it has an orbiter, it has a lander and a sender. It was on the big rocket, and it'll return to Earth in that kind of a, you know, rushing through the atmosphere with the heat shield to land, in this case, somewhere in Mongolia.
Can I ask, do you think, or do the Chinese think that the rocks on the moon have changed a huge amount over the last while? Why are we getting more rocks?
Well, that's interesting. And I actually thought at first, I really read this going, really, they're just looking for an excuse to go. As with nearly all space missions, this is more political than it is scientific. However, great science gets done along the way. And they're going to land on the near side of the moon in a very, very mountainous part where they know that there are a lot of old rocks. This compares to where the Apollo missions landed, where there were a lot of younger or relatively younger rocks. And so having these two time points, they say they'll be able to tell us an awful lot more about the evolution of the solar system, with the moon being called the great chronometer of the solar system. Basically, there's no atmosphere. It's a rocky place. Things haven't changed there a lot. And so you're able to look at it's a cleaner environment. So
turns out the Chinese know what they're doing and Jonathan doesn't.
They do, Jonathan. Absolutely. But you know how they find out where is younger rock and where is older rock? I thought this brought me back to an undergraduate experiment that I hated, which was looking at pictures of moon craters. They look for places that are more cratered, and they infer that there is older rock there because it's been dug up by kind of collisions from asteroids, compared to the flatter mares or seas on the moon, where they know that the rocks are younger. So more anon, no doubt, in terms of moon stories over the next couple of weeks for listeners.
Thanks very much, Shane. And Susan, our final story is about a funky new dinosaur.
Yeah, I love this. Published in Nature this week, scientists from Ohio University have discovered the fossilized remains of an early bird with the face of a velociraptor and the beak of a toucan. So it is a crow-sized bird that lived in Madagascar during the late Cretaceous period, which is when the dinosaurs roamed the Earth, so around 66 million years ago. And apart from being quite a bizarre find, imagine a creature resembling a tiny buck-toothed toucan flitting around from branch to branch, looking down on dinosaurs of Madagascar. This is a key finding as it adds to our knowledge of the evolutionary pathway of 11,000 living species of birds. The birds in your garden, as you look out listening to the show, as with all modern birds, have a beak that's made from one bone. Whereas the birds from the early Cretaceous period had a sort of a snout beak with lots of different bones in it. And this guy, who's called the Falcatichelys forsteri, has a face, as I said, as the dinosaur. So its upper jaw and face is like a dinosaur. And then the beak is made up of just one bone, which is like the modern birds, only he got it around tens of millions of years earlier than the birds that evolved as we know them. So it's this key link between the dinosaur era with a certain skull and then our modern birds that have a skull as we know it, as we see when we look out the window.
I love this. And actually, if you want to see a picture of said bird, what's it called, Susan?
It's the Falcatichelys forsteri.
The Falcatichelys forsteri?
Huh. Wouldn't you think they call it the Chickenosaurus, really? Come on.
I think this is very good. If you want to see a picture, you can have a look on our... It's not obviously a photograph of the bird. That would be impossible. It's an artist's rendering of the bird. You can check out our Twitter. It's twitter.com/newstalkscience. Speaking of birds... Shane, I noticed that you are, with interest, looking forward to the National Irish Garden Bird Survey. Do you want to tell us a bit
Absolutely.
About that?
So yes, you can log on. Birdwatch Ireland run a survey every year, and you can do it from the comfort of your own home, looking out the window, and you have to count up the birds that you see and report the largest group each week. So it is a fantastic activity for all the family to enjoy. I know my fiance is completely in charge of this survey in our house. I've told that I have observer status on this one. but we are very excited. Just yesterday we saw a flock of goldfinches outside the front, so we're hoping to be able to report them as part of the survey, which starts next week and runs for 13 weeks. And you can check it out, birdwatchireland.ie.
Excellent work, Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, the Big Bang, that idea, we're kind of on board with it. The math seems to work out, and the idea that everything came from nothing might seem completely and utterly preposterous, but so far we seem relatively happy with that. We kind of know a good bit about what happened in our universe in the last couple of million years, but there's quite a big gap in our knowledge that comes from just after the Big Bang, say a million years after the Big Bang. For another billion years, we don't really know what the universe looks like. And it's a very difficult thing to explore. It's something that Emma Chapman has tried to take on, though. She's written a book called First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. And she joins me now. Welcome to the program, Emma.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Why is this period of time, I think you describe it as the dark ages in the book, why is this time so hard to understand, and why is it so relatively easy for us to look at the Big Bang?
Well, the time after the Big Bang, there's not much happening to begin with. All you have is hydrogen gas pervading the universe. And then as that hydrogen gas coalesces together through gravity, you start to promote fusion. And that's when the first stars are born. But these first
before you go on, when the Big Bang happens, the only matter that exists in the universe is hydrogen.
Pretty much the normal matter. So there's lots of hydrogen, there's a bit of helium, but nothing really more complex than that, because the Big Bang is so violent, so hot, that anything bigger than hydrogen and helium, very, very simple atoms, simply can't form. But there's also, I should mention, and this just shows you how it's a bit of an afterthought for people working in this area, there's dark matter.
Yeah.
So dark matter is the most prevalent type of matter in our universe, but we call it dark because we have no idea what it is really at the minute. We haven't detected it, but it is there. And this web of dark matter underneath the surface that we can't see, so everything's dark, is what the hydrogen coalesces around. It's drawn to this dark matter. And that's why we get these first stars forming.
So we have the lightest elements on the periodic table, hydrogen, a little bit of helium. That's pretty much it in the universe. And yet we have to go from that to the world of matter and stuff that we have now. So what happens as the universe starts to cool down after the Big Bang?
Well, the universe is cooling down because it's expanding, and slowly we get to the point where more complex atoms can form within the stars, because the first stars have formed about 180 million years after the Big Bang, we think. And we go from a universe which has these very simple atoms to a universe that's full of diversity and complex atoms, which can then go on to form the first galaxies, the first planets, much later on, after a billion years. And so we've got to somehow get from this very simple universe to a very complicated universe. And it's these first stars that change the universe. About 180 million years after the Big Bang, they live, we think, only about a million years. But within that million years, which is an incredibly short time scale for a cosmologist, they create much heavier atoms within their fusion engines. And then they die very quickly in extremely bright pair instability supernova. It's a very posh way of saying big explosion. And all of those metals, we call them, all of those complex atoms get thrown out into the environment. And only then do we have the building blocks like carbon for us, like all the silicates and all of the oxygen, for example, that we breathe. All of those can then come together as galaxies and planets and us.
It's kind of crazy to think that you can make all of not just complex life, but all matter from a single element, essentially hydrogen. This era called the epoch of reionization is sort of the nursery to young stars. What were they called? Do we have a name for them? Is there a unique name for these early protostars? And how big were they?
So we call them interchangeably the first stars, metal-free stars. In astrophysics, I should explain that we're very used to rounding things up, like great distances. And so we've rounded up the periodic table too, because it's mostly hydrogen, helium. Our periodic table goes hydrogen, helium, metals. And so these stars...
what?
So, yeah.
So you have hydrogen, helium, and then everything else.
Yes, absolutely.
Much easier to memorize in school.
Yeah, and so we call these first stars metal-free stars, or equivalently population-3 stars. So we started out our understanding of stars by looking at the nearest one to us. It had quite a lot of metals in it, and we started to call these population-1. And then we realised that there's plenty of stars that actually have fewer metals in them. So we called them population-2. And then we extrapolated backwards to say, well, hang on, if the universe started out as metal-free, there must be a population of metal-free stars. So we called them population-3. So
it's now, just an you mean free of metal, not metal-3?
Yeah. As in yes, number sorry.
Because it is population-3, but it's metal-free.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, so okay. Full of tongue twisters, like epoch of reionization, that took me about a year to be able to pronounce. So these first stars, these metal-free stars, we have not observed them. So that's a big difference. Population-1 and population-2 are everywhere in our Milky Way. Population-3 are theoretical. So we know they must exist because of what I've explained about the chemical evolution of the universe. Mm. But we haven't seen them. And what we can figure out from the maths is that in the early universe, because there's only hydrogen, because there's only helium, for very boring chemical reasons that I'm not going into, they couldn't cool down as much, which means you have much bigger gas clouds and eventually much more massive stars. So we think they were around 100 times the mass of our sun, but there's simulations that actually say we could be looking at 1,000 times the mass of our sun for these first stars. And that's why they live such short lives, because the greater mass a star is, the more greedy they are, the quicker they run through their hydrogen fuel, and the faster they die.
These stars then presumably don't exist anymore. Is that right?
It's a really good question. Ah. And there are papers right now arguing this fact. So there is an idea, a very exciting idea that I do think is evidence-based, that there was a distribution of masses created by these first stars. And so while most of them were these, you know, 100 times the mass of our sun, we think there might have been a small tail of sibling stars created at, let's say, 80% the mass of our sun. So a little bit less massive, and because they went through their hydrogen slower, they could live around 13 billion years, which is the age of our universe. And so they might be in our own backyard in the Milky Way, hiding, camouflaged by the polluted Milky Way as it is. And there are people searching for these right now, and we call them very excitingly stellar archaeologists.
Ooh. What puzzles me is that we can say so much about the beginning of the universe, and we can actually even detect events and matter from the beginning of the universe, but we can't do the same for something that happened a whole billion years later. Why is that?
The signals are just very, very small. So we're used to optically detecting stars all around us because they're very bright and they're very close by. But if we want to look back in time, which is what we do as astrophysicists, the further we look back in distance, the further we're looking back in time, because light takes time to reach us. So we're looking back 13 billion years. That's really far away, and the signals are very, very small. So we simply cannot detect these first stars optically. But what we can do, and this is what the epoch of reionization is crucial for, is we can use hydrogen as a tracer for these first stars. So that simplest element that's pervading the universe first gets heated by these first stars because they're hot, and then it gets ionized, which means the electrons are stripped from the protons. There we can actually get a signal from that hydrogen as this happens. And that's what we're trying to find. And it's still a very, very small, faint signal, but it's shifted into the radio because it's lost energy as it comes to us. And so we can use radio telescopes to tune in to this time. It's still very, very difficult because the signal is very, very small. And we've been looking for this for 10 years now, but we're getting very, very close.
So stars that we're talking about, Is it possible, so am I right in saying that these enormous stars must have either died out by exploding into a supernova, and that presumably ejected material that possibly clumped together and started to cause these more complex elements? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. There is another thought that they could have turned into black holes.
Yeah.
Some of them. And these were the baby black holes. So they're very fascinating to look at, because one of the greatest mysteries that we have a little closer to home is, how did the supermassive black holes, for example, at the center of the Milky Way, get so large? Because when we calculate how much matter those black holes have guzzled over time, it doesn't make sense. They've got more massive than they should be. But if we go right back to these baby black holes, we can really fill in our understanding. So there's that exciting part too. And we can infer a lot of information about that through this epoch of reionization, through how they heated the gas and ionized it.
So it sounds like you're trying to identify interesting bodies in space and then sort of carbon date them in a way, using looking at what sort of state the hydrogen is in. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And you know what? I never thought of the analogy with carbon dating. That's absolutely fantastic. So I'm going to steal that.
So how do we do that then? What sort of technologies do we need to employ to discover these early stars, the first stars?
Well, there's a couple, but the one that I am most involved in is what's called radio interferometry. So another tongue twister. And what this is the idea that you have lots of very simple antennas in a very quiet place on Earth, and you get all of the signals through all of the antennas, and you combine them in a very difficult way. And then we could start to get the signal from this hydrogen. So for example, I'm working to help build what's called the Square Kilometre Array, mostly based for my work in the Western Australian desert. So it's very, very quiet there in terms of radio noise. And what we're going to do is we're going to place 130,000 radio antennas in this desert. We're going to link them all up, and that way we tune in to this signal from this hydrogen.
Why is taking optical pictures just not as useful?
They're so faint that you cannot get that signal. It's taken us, you know, until what, 2011, to get the technology to be able to even get the signal from the hydrogen. And the reason that we can do that is because there's a heck of a lot of hydrogen in the early universe, and so all of that is sending signals to us. And what we call it is 21 centimeter radiation, because hydrogen produces photons of exactly 21 centimeters in wavelength, gets stretched as it comes to us. It loses energy because of the expansion of the universe. It gets to about 2 meters in wavelength, which is straight into the radio waves. So we've got a chance here.
And just for, I say listeners, for me, the optical telescopes are looking at light, which is obviously one form of energy, and then radio telescopes are looking at energy that's given off by this matter, this radiation, and that's a different form of energy. And we can look at some bodies that are not that far away, and we can determine their chemical composition, and we can understand quite a bit about them. But by looking at the radio frequency, we can really get a much closer picture of what's going on in these further distances.
Yeah, it's about exploiting the different wavelengths of light, just like on Earth, how if you break your bones, or let's say you break your wrist, you could look at it and go, oh gosh, that doesn't look good. But we really need an X-ray in order to shed more light, pun, on what's going on. And it's exactly the same. So we can look optically all around us, but it's in the radio waves that the universe, you know, really comes alive.
So if we manage to identify one of these enormous gas stars from the beginnings, well, not the beginning, but nearly the beginnings of our universe, if we find one now, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us firstly about how the universe began, because we really like to fill in gaps in our knowledge. Mm. It's dangerous to have a billion years missing from our universe, because if you don't have enough data, you can draw incorrect conclusions very easily. So it tells us a little bit about the black holes, as I've said, in the present universe. There's lots to learn, not only just about the first stars, the first black holes, how our universe evolved chemically. This is all really interesting stuff to astrophysicists. So I'm not going to apologize to say that. Why wouldn't you look at all of this stuff? Because we can look back in time, we can fill in this huge gap. And the most exciting thing that can happen in science is an unknown unknown. So something we haven't planned for. And actually the first look into this time happened about 2 years ago. We've got preliminary data that we've seen when the first stars formed, which is why I can tell you roughly 180 million years, because we've measured that raise in temperature, if you will. And it was completely unexpected. It did it in a way, the temperature of the universe was colder than we expected. So the temperature of the hydrogen was colder than we expected. And none of our models fit it. And so we've been spending 2 years changing our perception of what the early universe was like.
Is it the darkest part of our understanding, that first billion years? After that, does it get easier to understand and explore?
Yes, because we've got much larger galaxies. You cannot form galaxies with the first stars. But when they die, they seed the universe with metals. We can get population two. And those last long enough to form galaxies. The galaxies are much brighter. And so, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope, I don't know how many listeners have seen these, but please look it up. The Hubble Telescope produced what's called the ultra deep field. And it really dug into the universe for billions of years old. And it found just so many galaxies in what is a postage stamp size of the sky. So we really can get a much greater hold. Not to say there's not mysteries closer to home, but we've got a little bit more chance in terms of looking at them optically, for example.
Oh, well, it's great to speak to someone who's so enthusiastic about their work. And you can find that enthusiasm in the book. It's called First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. Dr. Enema Chapman, physicist and Royal Society Dorothy Hodgkin Fellow based in Imperial College. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
She's great, isn't she? And there's something about someone who can get you excited about inanimate objects. That's just a real skill when it comes to communicating science, I think. Right, time to look back at some of your comments and texts from last week. Usually producer Aidan McKelvey joins us, but I don't think his heart's in it anymore. Just kidding, he's actually very busy. He'd hate that. He's weirdly dedicated to this program in a way that I'm not really dedicated about any of my children. We look back then on our own at the texts and tweets and comments from last week, and I tried to find the context for this comment, but I couldn't find it. Someone texted in, what about travel and impact on climate change? So I'm just going to have to answer it at face value in that I don't know why you texted that in. It was probably related to something we were talking about, but yes, travel is bad, but they're working on it, in a nutshell. I wish I could help you more. If Aidan was here, he probably could help us. But as I mentioned only a few seconds ago, he's not. Second one is, how does the Earth hang on to nothing? That's from Kath Curley in Athlone. You know what, Kath, that is a really interesting way of putting it, that the Earth hangs on nothing. When actually, if you look at the Earth is pissing it around the solar system, and the solar system is pissing it around the universe. There's this sense that we're just sort of sitting here, but even our own Earth is spinning. In fact, I believe that by the time you go to sleep and by the time you go to bed and you wake up, you'll have traveled over 7 million miles. It could possibly be 7 billion, and I know there's a big order of magnitude of difference there. I just can't remember, and I also don't have the time to look it up. Someone said it at some point somewhere during the program, and I cannot remember whether it was millions or billions. But anyway, you travel a very, very, very long distance in the space of one day. So we don't hang on anything. We actually spin around in lots of different ways. But we are held in orbit by the sun, and that is because the sun has a lot of mass, which is stuff, and stuff attracts other stuff. And if you have lots and lots of stuff in something like the sun or even a planet, then stuff that doesn't have as much stuff will go to it. And what happens with an orbit is if the stuff that is going around the big object has enough momentum going in one direction, it'll just continue to fall. And by continuing to fall and being pulled at the same time, it enters this orbit. And so it feels like it's hanging there, but actually it's moving quite a lot. That wasn't very scientific in my terminology, but I hope you got the gist. Frank says, we were talking about the Danish mask study. And in this study, Lara said, look, there's no statistical difference in terms of wearing masks or not wearing masks as to whether or not you get coronavirus, right? This is one study, but it was well done. She said, this doesn't mean that wearing masks are a bad idea, not at all. What it's saying is it doesn't have a big impact on whether or not you get coronavirus from the environment. Frank says, there's a big proviso that should be stated. The subjects were asked to perform social distancing and hand washing. I can just as easily conclude that the distancing and hand washing are more important, and masks may give some additional prevention. Indeed, they are more important. Masks may give additional prevention. And we know in terms of if you're wearing a mask, you giving it to someone else, we have good data on that. Whether or not you get it because you're wearing a mask is different. And so they say, Frank goes on to say, as we don't seem to be able to judge 2 meters routinely, and correct frequent hand washing is not as easy as it sounds without quality training, it can be suggested that masks may be of some protective use. And in addition, I didn't hear any comment on transmission from the mask wear, which I've sort of covered. So, Frank, you're correct. You walked away from the radio, I believe, at the time, is what you said. We did say that it's good for you wear a mask to protect others, and there's good evidence that works, that hand washing and social distancing are fantastic and the best measures if they're done correctly in terms of reducing the spread of the virus. But if you wear a mask getting coronavirus, it doesn't have a huge effect, it seems, from this Danish study. So just to clarify that, I hope I have, if not, made you more confused. And Brian McGinn says, I understand you reporting this, but I can imagine the cohort who don't like nuance jumping on this when they're asked, where is the evidence for their batshit notions about not wearing masks? Look, that is an enormous Pandora's box when it comes to science. And scientists, you know, of course, science is political, but the evidence should be unbiased and objective, and it should be gathered objectively. And in that case, when you do that, the results, you have to present the results of what the data shows. You can interpret them, but you have to say, this is what we see. Of course, a scientist saying, well, we're not sure why this happens, can be jumped upon by a clever troll on YouTube and say, well, you said you don't know why. Well, then maybe you don't understand it at all, and so on and so forth. I think people who don't fully understand the method of science can easily poke holes in it due to their own lack of knowledge and their own ignorance. You know, we were trying to be very clear about what this study says. I think it's important not to ignore a big study come out of Denmark that people are talking about, because then, of course, you'd be accused of cherry picking the stories you want to do. So it is tricky, because explaining certainty, communicating risk, these things that are not black and white and binary, as so many things in life are not. It is tricky, and you do open yourself up for misinterpretation if you do not communicate clearly. So it is an issue, but what are you going to do? You can't pretend the world is 2D when it's 3D. I hope that goes some distance to answering some of your comments. Thank you very much for those. Keep them coming. If you have comments on this week's show, science@newstalk.com. That's it for this week's Future Proof. Thanks to production team Aidan McKelvey, Garrett Mulhall, Steve Daunt, and Steve McClune, who was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in Future Proof Extra on Tuesday, and then back again for normal programming on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.